Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny, very pleased to be with you. We've got another jam-packed show for you this morning, including learning what's happening to some of the historical art that has adorned the walls and halls of the now-closed Good Samaritan Hospital. Up first, WISO's Recovery Stories series brings you conversations from the heart of Dayton's opioid crisis. Today, we meet 31-year-old Sarah Clay of Urbana. In 2007, she met her husband, Justin.
We worked together at a factory. We hit it off pretty quickly. We moved in, and I was pregnant within 4 months.
Their family grew, but everything soon changed when the couple fell deep into opioid addiction. Today, Sarah is in recovery, and Justin's mom, Kathy Stewart, helps to care for her 4 children. Less than a year after finally getting clean, Justin died.
When Justin got his cancer diagnosis, we were already using at the time. He got to a really dark place. He just kind of gave up. I remember dealing with overdoses and him asking me next time, please don't call the squad. And that was a hard thing, you know, because I wouldn't be able to do that. When did you realize Justin and I had a problem?
The kids would report that they had not eaten or that they had to fix their own meal while parents were resting. How can you explain the overwhelming power to allow drugs to supersede the care of your children?
At first, it was almost like a pick-me-up. I remember even saying one time, I'm a good mom when I'm high, because I could go run with the kids and play with the kids. And it sounds, you know, insane to say now because, you know, ultimately my children were abandoned. But it got to the point where my kids were just in the way. I needed drugs to live. I remember the day Children's Services came to the house and told me they were taking the kids. There was no question in my mind who I would call, who I wanted them to be with, and who I knew would take them. You were just always there for us. You finally had to, for our benefit, had to stop being there. I think you kind of realized that you were enabling us other ways.
When it did come down to an electric bill not being paid or it turned off, I wanted to go and pay that, but I had to draw a line and say they had the money, but they chose to use that money for an addiction.
Eventually, that did end up helping us out because that made us kind of hit a spot to where we were actually able to see we needed help. One of the worst 2 weeks that I can recall is the 2 weeks before I went to treatment. I had done some very hurtful things to people I loved. I stole from you. I mean, I lied and did whatever I could to get drugs that week. Eventually, everything ran out, and I was very sick. I wanted to die. And I just remember, you know, you were just trying to help me, try to get me in somewhere as quick as possible. But at that time, we couldn't find anything.
I remember pulling up to the emergency room to wait for you and seeing a lady laying on the ground outside the waiting room. The homeless woman was you laying out on the sidewalk, and I was in shock. I tried to deter the children, but they did see their mother laying there. It just broke my heart to see you in that situation. I would have never have guessed that it would have came to that, where you've lost your dignity.
I felt lifeless. Addiction it's a horrible thing. I think families suffer just as much, if not possibly worse, than the addict, because the addict's able to numb. The family's not. They're, you know, being worried that they're going to get the phone call, that person's dead. But there is hope, and recovery is possible. I entered treatment at Access Residential Hospital in Dayton, Ohio. It was really the beginning of my life. And I always had hope that me and Justin would get our lives back together, raise our children together. Unfortunately, the day I got out of treatment, Justin passed away. That kind of hurts. I'm not sure exactly where we stood in his heart the day he died. I know he loved me.
I know he loved you too. That would be my gift to you to say. I know he wanted to be together as a family. I just know he wanted it to be healthy. I'm very proud of you and how you present yourself in the community. It does take a strong woman, keeping your head up high, and you're doing well.
And it feels good to hear that. It feels good to hear people tell me they're proud of me. People can see the change in me. I'm just completely a different person today. And I like that person. And I want to apologize for all those things that I've done. You know, I'm terribly sorry. I wish I could go back and not do those things.
Apologies accepted, and I love you, and you know that.
I love you.
This summer, Sarah regained custody of her three youngest children. Recovery Stories is produced by Jess Mador. For more information, visit our website at wyso.org. Well, as the November election nears, the race to be Ohio's next governor has been getting more of the attention, but voters will cast ballots on several races, including Secretary of State, a position that helps shape future elections. WOSU's Nick Evans spent some time with the major party candidates.
On a drizzly Saturday, I met Frank LaRose at the Marion Popcorn Festival.
So what do you guys suggest? I suggest to get three because it's $3 a bag or three for $9.
Sounds like
in November, the Republican, LaRose, faces off against Democrat Kathleen Klein. Both currently serve in the state legislature, and they're trying to make the leap from representing a few hundred thousand to all 11.5 million Ohioans. That's complicated by one very important question on many voters' minds. What exactly does the Secretary of State do?
If you ask the average Ohioan, they probably would not know.
That's OSU political scientist Herb Asher. The secretary has a grab bag of responsibilities, licensing businesses, collecting campaign finance records, even commissioning notaries. But Asher says,
the key thing about the Ohio Secretary of State is that he or she is an independently elected statewide officer whose most visible set of responsibilities deals with running elections in Ohio. So chief elections officer of the state of Ohio.
Current Secretary John Husted recently won a narrow victory in the U.S. Supreme Court. They upheld Ohio's practice of removing voters from the rolls after they sit out six consecutive elections and failed to return a notice sent to their registered address. Kathleen Clyde says that approach is unacceptable.
I want to, you know, center this, bring us back to a normal process that makes sure we're not catching people who are still eligible to vote and still want to vote, as we see with this broken process that Ohio uses now.
And LaRose isn't exactly trumpeting the procedure.
We've got a Supreme Court decision saying that Ohio's method is constitutional. That doesn't mean it's optimal, right? So let's work on making it better. And that starts with a conversation at the state legislature where we make the laws.
LaRose often strikes a bipartisan tone, emphasizing his work across the aisle on redistricting. He says he caught a lot of flack from fellow Republicans when he signed on to a reform measure in his first year in the state Senate.
My response inevitably was some version of, listen, this is not for me anyway what's about what's best for one party or another. It's about making our democracy function right.
In addition to their records, both candidates tout their latest legislative proposals to improve election security. LaRose would create a cybersecurity task force within the Ohio National Guard to help identify vulnerabilities in the election system. Kathleen Clyde is pushing a more comprehensive retooling, with paper ballots, post-election audits, and a new cybersecurity director within the secretary's office.
And he or she would be advised by a bipartisan council of security experts and voter advocates. So I think that is a comprehensive plan to address the threats that we face in our election system.
Herb Asher sees both as competent, impressive candidates and says they're backing ideas that cross party lines, like protecting and encouraging voting. He also notes winning a statewide race could give the eventual secretary the name recognition they need to run for higher office. For Ohio Public Radio, I'm Nick Evans.
I'm Jerry Kenney. You're listening to WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO. Thanks for joining us this Sunday morning. Today on Veterans Voices, we hear from a Beaver Creek Air Force veteran, Jason Evett. He's the founder of a web store called Airborne Outfitters, which makes and sells camping supplies. Evett's business grew out of his determination to overcome PTSD. Here's his story, which may be difficult for some listeners to hear.
One day, three of my NCOs grabbed me, and, you know, we're monkeying around, and but they ended up taping me and tying me to a big push cart that we used to put parachutes on. And so they wheel me outside. You know, I figured they were just going to leave me out there and let me be cold for a minute or whatever. But what they actually did was they ended up taking turns waterboarding me. And so I had no idea what that was. I just knew that it was the scariest thing I had ever experienced in my life. I mean, it shook me. And I, you know, tried to play it off afterwards, but, I mean, I was a wreck. I'm a year and a half in the military. I don't know what's right, what's wrong. I know what feels right and wrong, you know, whatever. But anyway, fast forward to 2014, and I was struggling. Talked to my commander and just said, I need to go get some help, and went and talked to a psychologist, and it was probably 2 weeks and 200 questions later, and she diagnosed me with PTSD. But, you know, there's deployments to the Middle East. There's, you know, a lot of stuff that kind of added up. So anyway, I'd get off work at the end of the day, and then I'd go home, and I wouldn't have something to occupy my time. I do not do well with idle hands. So I look at, you know, what else can I do? What else can I do in addition to work that I'm not going to have to think about things after work, you know, when I have downtime? The thing that I always went back to was, where's my passion? My passion is in the outdoors. And I just said, you know what? I'm going to go to the library. And I went to the library every day and checked out an entrepreneurial book. And I read like 12 books in 22 days or something like that. And so I went and bought a sewing machine and got busy, right? And the things that I made were garbage. But it was something. And then I just kept honing that craft and got better at it. And by the way, so, you know, I went from being in a very horrible place mentally to having something to focus on, and then continue with therapy and start taking the meds. And then that's kind of when my world came normal again. You know, it felt like a crane just lifted me out of a ditch and put me back on the road, and I was great after that. And so it gave me a light at the end of the tunnel. We all know that alcohol and self-medicating does not fix your problems, but a lot of us have been there. Neither does suicide, right? And so if I can do it, anybody else can do it. You don't have to create a business, right? You can do whatever. You can learn to play music, or you can start a nonprofit or whatever. Whatever you're passionate about. Had it not been for having something like that to focus on, the outcome could have obviously been different.
That was Air Force veteran Jason Evett, founder of the web store called Airborne Outfitters. He was interviewed by Navy veteran and fellow Wright State University student Jeremy Tack of Dayton. Veterans Voices is produced in collaboration with the Veteran and Military Center at Wright State University. This series is supported by WrightPath Credit Union. In 2009, a young man in Wisconsin built a replica of a one-room schoolhouse, put some books inside it, and put it in his front yard. It was a tribute to his mother, a schoolteacher. The idea was that anyone could take a book or leave a book, and it caught on. There are some 85,000 of these neighborhood book exchanges now around the world, and they're known as Little Free Libraries. WISO Community Voices producer Alan Steiger found a husband and wife who became enamored with the idea and have set a goal to get 100 little free libraries built in the Miami Valley. Their names are Ryan and Amber Ireland.
What was the first step then in getting it going?
We had to start a nonprofit. In order to do that, we went and talked to them at Green Giving, and they have been a tremendous help to us.
And how did you find interest in the community?
You start talking about giving away books for free to people. There's a ton of interest out there. Everybody wants to have easy access to books. Everybody likes the idea of a little free library. They look cute, you know, and everybody seems to know of one somewhere around them in a park or a neighbor's yard or whatever. And so when you say, hey, What our organization does is we build it, we register it for you, we'll stock it for you, we maintain it for you, we make sure that everything is taken care of. All you have to do is, if you start noticing that you're running low on books, you send us an email and somebody will be out in 48 hours to restock. And that's the commitment. Reading is such a good thing for a community. It's good for people on an individual level. You're going to learn stuff, whether they're fiction or nonfiction. It builds empathy. We can sorely use a lot of empathy in our communities. And I just think that books should always be within arm's reach of people. There should never be an area where it is hard to get the books. And so we look at what are some of the community parks where people have limited mobility, where there is no public transit. Can we put books within arm's reach for those people too?
How does this differ from a regular library that loans books for free?
Well, a Little Free Library is always open. There are no fines or fees. If you are to end up taking a book and never returning it, we're none the wiser. We're not going to come find you. In fact, I think it's a great thing that people own books. Book ownership is one of the keys to success later in life. If you're exposed to owning the written word between the ages of 0 and 5, you're much likely to do better in school, far less likely to be incarcerated later. The list goes on and on and on. I'm happy when people take books and keep them, and we're happy to keep stocking them.
I went with Ryan to restock a Little Free Library in Clifton, a tiny village in rural Greene County. It was a really rainy day, but Ryan was determined to make sure the little library was filled with a variety of books.
Said you had an umbrella?
And we're walking to the Little Free Library here in the rain. We've got an umbrella to protect us. Ryan's gonna open up the door and see what's inside.
All right, so it looks like we've got some religious literature. We've also got Elvis and Me by Priscilla Presley. Some good fiction, nonfiction. A lot of paperback novels. So I'm going to try and mix it up a little bit and give them some variety. So I got a crate of books over here. Somebody donated a Like New Condition Robert Ludlum novel. And then I've got a number of kids' age readers here. Kids' books are always the ones that go the fastest. We have to make sure that we keep those well-stocked and always on the bottom shelf with kids' books in order to make sure that kids can actually reach them.
No rare books and special things.
We do have some special things, actually, in Little Free Libraries. We don't tell people where, but we do stock a number of advanced reader copies. So those are books that have not yet gone to print and cannot be sold. And so I get those at conventions or from authors and or for review. And when I'm finished with them, they get added into the collection. So sometimes you can read a book even before it comes out. Another thing that we've done is we've stocked first editions and autographed books. We've had a number of authors autograph their books, donate them to the Little Free Libraries, and then we just put them out there into the world and somebody gets a really nice surprise.
Ryan Ireland is the communications coordinator of the Greene County Public Library. He and his wife Amber are co-chairs of the Third Story Literacy Project, which has a goal to build 100 Little Free Libraries across the Miami Valley. That story was from WISO Community Voices producer Alan Steiger. Culture Couch is made possible by a generous grant from the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISO Weekend. Good Samaritan Hospital in Dayton has been closed now for more than 2 months. The future is still unclear as to what will happen to the former medical facility that served as a West Dayton cornerstone for more than 80 years. When the hospital turned 75 years old, a bronze statue depicting the parable of the Good Samaritan was commissioned, and since then, it has stood next to the main entrance of the hospital, and since its opening in 1932, on the surrounding grounds and throughout the halls and offices inside the hospital were countless other sculptures, painting, and historic works of art, each piece with a story to tell. As it was closing, one WISO listener asked us what was to become of the art that was inside Good Samaritan. To find out, we contacted Premier Health and Good Samaritan Hospital Foundation. In this interview, Jenny Lewis, Foundation President and CEO, and Sister of Charity Carol Bauer tell us what's happening to the art and how the legacy of Good Samaritan Hospital will be preserved. First, we hear from Sister Carol, who has extensive knowledge on much of that art, where it came from, and where it's going.
I'm the art guru, officially. Okay. I actually have had the privilege over my years at Good Sam being involved in the purchase of much of our art. So from the early days, it was general practice of the sisters to believe the importance of art, everywhere from local artists participating in the development of the chapel to the actual commissioning of pieces at the time of a particular building or expansion of the hospital. One of my favorite is a statue that was commissioned by the sisters who actually were doing ministry in Rome when Good Sam was building a building that was known as the Madonna Pavilion, and they commissioned an artist in Rome to do a marble statue of the Madonna and Child, and it has been part of the heritage of the hospital ever since, all the way to more recently, Paul Melia, who is a local Dayton artist, did a piece, oh, I would say maybe 25, 30 years ago, of the history of the Sisters of Charity in Dayton. That's also in the hospital. And then every room and every hallway in the hospital over the decades has had art.
And I don't think many people put much thought into what the philosophy is of placing art pieces within a care center like Good Sam.
I think there are several things. The history of Good Sam has a very strong realization that healthcare is a holistic element. Yes, there's healing, there's caring for the body, but real healing requires the emotional support and the spiritual support for the patient. And art, good art, whether it be scenery or flowers or whatever, really does feed the spirit and the emotions. And so it was simply a part of everything we did whenever a building was built over the 86 years now.
So with the decision to close Good Samaritan, I imagine that this was something that was immediately thought of. What do we do with this art? Where does it go?
I'm actually responsible for that right now. Been doing a lot of that as we do the decommissioning. There are maybe a half a dozen pieces that were actually commissioned by the Sisters of Charity in the early decades, probably the first 60 years when it was owned and sponsored by the Sisters of Charity. Those are being returned to the Sisters of Charity, and they will be at the Mother House in the art collection of the sisters. And the sisters are very proud of their art collection and will easily arrange tours with groups, etc. We have also reached out to all of the other premier organizations to express interest in any of our art. We are gradually distributing it through the other organizations as well. And eventually, I suspect, there will be some things that may wind up being available to the public.
Are you working on a time frame for how the art is disseminated?
Probably what we would call an ASAP, mainly because we want to be sure everything is safely placed before any demolition or any undoing of the facility. So I would say my goal for the artwork is the end of 18.
And so obviously this is going to take a while for actually all of the furnishings within Good Samaritan. Can we talk about the state of Good Sam as it is now?
Actually, we have a consultant that has been working with a group of us. There are a group of us who are actually the people responsible for the decommissioning. We've got lots of help, lots of people working with us. But we are gradually working first and foremost with the other organizations in Premier for the placement.
What are your biggest challenges?
Actually, I got started very early. I actually have a catalog of, I have a picture of every art piece in the hospital. It has proved to be the way in which to work with the other organizations to make selections, and it's been helpful. Obviously, also with Jenny and the foundation, there are some of our larger, more elegant art pieces that have also been donated or contributed to the donation of their existing. We've been working together to make sure our donors know what we'd like to recommend. They've been extremely supportive of that, and much of it will simply be available somewhere in Dayton or with the Sisters of Charity in Cincinnati.
Jenny, as the organization overseeing all of this, can you talk a little bit about the foundation and your mission?
Sure. The Good Samaritan Hospital Foundation board is very committed to continuing supporting building a healthier community here in Dayton and are supporting our Good Sam families who will continue to use a facility within Premier and also our North Campus. With our donors, donor intent is very important. So as Sister mentioned, we are working with our donors to make sure that whether it's a piece of art or a plaque or a bench or a program, you know, if it needs to move and to continue, we are working with our donors to make sure that we're doing that. As she mentioned, some of the larger pieces we're still figuring out, but our donors are definitely involved. Some of the other things like programming, we're continuing to support our Mothers Empowered program. It's really important to us. The Samaritan Homeless Clinic, we're continuing to support. So from a board perspective and a donor perspective, we are very committed to our Good Samaritan community and family and working with individuals as well as with our board.
I'm glad you mentioned that because so we're here to talk about the art, but you mentioned some of the plaques and other dedications that reside on the property. And so I think it's a nice idea that you're looking for new homes for all of that as well.
We are. And, you know, some people have asked us if they could take their plaque with them and that, you know, we're working with them on that. But really, we want to make sure that we honor that gift and that donor intent. And if we can place that at our North Campus or somewhere else within our Premier facilities, we want to make sure that in working with our donors, we follow their intent.
I think with a lot of people who, for whatever reason, they have family, friends in hospitals, there's often a quiet space around the hospital mm-hmm. where you just need to sit and relax and kind of think things through. Mm-hmm. And that's what these little spaces mean to people with the placement of the art and some of these dedicated mm-hmm. plaques.
That's very true. We have some stained glass windows that we had donated for a reflection room in particular. We're working on creating a second reflection room at our North Campus because we have a reflection room there, but as you know, we've expanded, and there's interest in moving from one space to another and continuing to work with that donor to make sure that they are satisfied and involved in where this goes.
The logistics that I'm imagining taking place on all of this just seems incredible because you just mentioned stained glass windows.
So we're looking for spaces where things will work. Because we know that the things that we have are beautiful, as Sister said. They're beautiful. So I'm working with our leadership and our donors together to find a place for things. We've been successful so far. There are things in the works that, you know, we don't have finalized, but honestly, I think our donors have been very wonderful. They're committed to our Good Sam community and to support our patients and families.
And when you mention quiet space, et cetera, Good Samaritan Hospital, that for 86 years has been the chapel, and that is also one of the sites of incredible art. That chapel, built in time for the hospital to open in 32, is almost exclusively Dayton artists. So there's a wonderful history of incredible art history in Dayton right there in that room as well. And it's also one of those places that we are carefully looking at for the real possibility for the future.
I guess I would just finally ask, so obviously we have the foundation and other Good Sam facilities, but how will the legacy of Good Samaritan Hospital be remembered? How will it be documented and preserved?
We actually, since most of the history of Good Sam was during the sponsorship by the Sisters of Charity, the archives that tell the story of that history have been sent back to the Mother House. They actually technically belong to the Sisters of Charity, and the Sisters' archives are very willing to work with anybody. What they have done is they have the capacity to digitize everything so we can work with anybody looking to research, anybody looking to understand the history, or whatever is definitely underway. But even beyond that, as Jenny was implying, we are committed to remembering that story and heritage. And Jenny has mentioned a couple of times the North Campus. There's a real strong commitment on their part and effort to take many of the things that will memorialize that history to that campus. And we're working on it together. It's a lengthy process, but it's a detailed process too. What are the things that best do that?
Yeah, there's a group of us working together to figure out how do we best memorialize Good Sam and carry on that legacy and share the history and traditions. And again, you know, our community and our board are behind us, so.
Well, I want to thank you both for your time and the information. I know a lot of people will be interested in what we've had to talk about today. So, Sister Carol and Jenny, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Good to be with you.
Over the past decade, the neighborhoods that make up what is known as Old North Dayton have been transformed. With the arrival of immigrants from countries such as Turkey and Russia, immigrants have been central to the development of Old North Dayton since their arrival as laborers in the early 20th century. Today on Senior Voices, lifelong Daytonian Lewis Eckert, who is of German and Polish descent, recalls growing up there in the 1960s and 70s. He spoke with Dayton Metro Library volunteer interviewer Carol Jackson.
The Old North Dayton area had a Polish community, a Lithuanian community, and then, of course, a German and Hungarian community. And the Polish church was St. Adalbert's, the Lithuanian was Holy Cross, and St. Stephen's was the Hungarian, and then Holy Rosary was the German church.
Was there usually a feeling of safety for you as a young boy in the neighborhood?
You always felt like you knew somebody on every block. If you did anything wrong, your parents were going to hear about it. Mm-hmm. And so You knew that there were people that were always keeping an eye on you.
Are there any negative memories about that time of growing up in the north end of Dayton?
Now when people talk about the bullying thing and whatnot, that was just something that was just a fact of life. I mean, I was a small boy. Like for a period, I was always the last person picked for the basketball team, the last person for a particular salt or baseball group. And as such, that's where you learn how to get along with the group. Particularly like with the baseball teams, it was roughly one-third Lithuanian, one-third Polish, and one-third Briar. And there was never any trouble with any of the groups. Everybody seemed to get along very well. Mm-hmm. It was very rare that we had any disagreements. I am still a member of the Polish Club on Valley Street, and that was the first president of the Polish Club was the grandfather of my best friend. So between the church and the Polish Club, it was its social and religious community that everybody was involved with. Kaiser High School was our local high school, but that was located over on the other side of North Dayton, where it was not a great area to travel because you went over into some of the other sections. And my parents were adamant that I was not going to go to Kaiser High School. Mm-hmm. So that's how I ended up at Patterson, although my brother went to Chaminade and my three sisters went to Julianne. Chaminade at the time was having some curriculum issues, and that it was not, it was beginning to lose some of its luster of being a quality school. So my parents decided they thought Patterson was a better career move for me.
They really watched out for what was best for their five kids, didn't they?
They somewhat helped steer all of us towards a career. My two older sisters were both teachers. Went to University of Dayton. My brother is an accountant, went through Wright State. And then, of course, myself going to GMI and with the connection to Delco Products, it made it an easy approach. My dad was very familiar with that. Then my younger sister, she was a little wayward one. She ended up going to Ohio State. Yeah, so she didn't quite have our parents didn't pick out a career path for her quite as defined as the rest of us. Mm-hmm.
Lewis Eckert and his wife now live in Kettering. He shared his memories related to working at Delco Products and Dayton's heyday as a manufacturing center during a previous Senior Voices segment. He was interviewed by Carol Jackson. This interview was edited by Community Voices producer Dave Barber. Senior Voices is a collaboration between the Dayton Metro Library, Rebuilding Together Dayton, and WYSO, made possible through the generous support of the Delmar Healthcare Fund of the Dayton Foundation. This week on Dayton Youth Radio, we hear from a Centerville High School student about support she's gotten from youth counselor Miss Myers. Here's Basim Blunt to introduce our story.
When teenagers deal with depression, sometimes it's a good thing to have someone at school to talk to.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Gaines and I'm with Miss Myers. Could you please say and state your position at Centerville High School?
Beth Myers, and I'm the intervention counselor here at the high school. I try to solve problems, listen to kids, and come up with solutions to what they're going through and what they're challenged with.
Do you think depression is a common problem with teens today?
Yes.
I'm 17. I'm a senior at Centerville. I'm in the marching band.
I'm the color guard. I've been doing that every single year of high school. I'm very shy. I'm very closed off. I like being alone. I like just doing things by myself.
When something bad would happen to me, my brain would dwell on it. I remember I was learning how to ride a bike. I fell off and scraped my knee. I didn't want to ride the bike anymore because I was afraid of getting hurt. Before my parents separated, there was a lot of yelling and arguing, and I knew it wasn't right, but even after they divorced, I worried that I still wouldn't have a normal family. By eighth grade, my world got darker. That little voice in my head kept telling me I wasn't good enough. I wasn't pretty enough. I wasn't skinny enough. And it just fueled me with this hatred. And I started self-harming. I felt like I was going to feel that way forever. I spent hours at night trying to fall asleep, but all I could think about was how much I hated myself and how much better everything would be if I was just dead. There's no way that I could just tell my mom how I had been feeling. That's how I found myself in the guidance counselor's office one morning.
What are some signs you think that parents should look for in children?
I think a change in personality and behavior, and I think it's really important we acknowledge that teenagers certainly go through different phases and stages, without a doubt. But we have to be careful not to generalize and think everything's a stage or a phase. When we see things like isolation, emotional responses that are a little out of the ordinary, I think watching sleep and eating habits, I think as parents, we have to be tuned in to our kid. Not think we're tuned in, but really be tuned in. And it's our responsibility to initiate conversations, to not always lecture or get angry when we don't hear what we want. Kids need to know that we're there for them.
Do you think it's hard for parents to kind of relate to their kids or vice versa because, like, it's kind of different from when they grew up?
You know, I think that it is different for sure. Definitely. I think as far as relating, we as adults, because life is so much so on the fast track, we have to step off and really listen and not say things like, oh, just move on. Oh, it'll be fine. Oh, don't worry about it. Like, we have to kind of have those meaningful, intentional conversations.
If a parent thinks their child is depressed, do you have any advice for them on how to handle it?
You know, I would probably, the first thing I would do is probably reach out to school. You know, school sees kids more than parents see kids. There's been some misconceptions that we don't want the school to know or whatnot. We're all working in this together, and I think we can give some kind of light. I think if the, you know, student or family is involved in some type of organization that's supportive, a spiritual organization or just a volunteer type thing, you know, enlisting adults to kind of talk with that particular child, I think a coach having a conversation, just adults in general reaching out. I think I wouldn't hesitate if, you know, there was a real concern to seek some professional help.
When I woke up for my first day of senior year, I almost started crying. I had survived. 5 years ago, I had never really pictured a future for myself, but here I am. And I've gone from thinking about killing myself in eighth grade to thinking about going to college and actually having a future as an adult.
For Dayton Youth Radio at Centerville High School, this is Elizabeth Gaines.
That was a story entitled Close By, written and produced by Elizabeth Gaines, a graduate from the class of 2018 at Centerville High School. Special thanks to Trisha Rapak at Centerville. For Dayton Youth Radio, this is Basim Blunt.
Support for Dayton Youth Radio comes from the Virginia W. Kettering Foundation and the Ohio Arts Council. I'm Jerry Kenny. That's it for this edition of WISO Weekend on 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958, thanks to generous listeners like you. We'll be back next Sunday morning at 10 o'clock. Up next on WISO, it's Vic McCunis with the Book Nook.